many, many years, and got a heap of knowledge.
Thank you.
November 28th, 2014, at Matchless Gifts in London. So tonight we're going to be looking at how to deal with deceit. And for this we're looking mostly at Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 8, Text 4, and also Mana Shiksha by Raghunath Das Goswami, verses 6 and 7. Yes. Yes. Much every human being, I think we can say every living being, but we could restrict it to human beings, has a need, an actual need, for authenticity, for honesty. I mean, we could even say the animals have that need. It's pretty hard to live if you don't understand things as they are. Just like sometimes animals get caught in a trap because they think it's just some leaves when it's actually a trap. So authenticity is one of our main needs. It's also definitely a violation of which perhaps causes us the most grief of almost anything else. I think the thing that really tears at us is when there's deceit, when there's cheating, especially if it's intentional. Now, particularly if it's malicious, and especially if it's intentional, even if it isn't malicious. But even if it's non-intentional, we're really torn apart by deceit. And we can handle almost anything if people are honest about it. It's quite interesting, you know, what we get the most angry at politicians or businesses or family and friends or is sometime when there's a lack of honesty. When we're told, okay, it's going to be like this, and actually it's not. We're told something has a certain value, and it really has less value than that, when we think that we can depend on somebody or something. And perhaps this is one of our greatest needs, because we're not independent in taking care of ourselves. We have to depend on others. And nobody is going to be able to just be an island unto themselves. And in order to depend on others, we have to be able to trust them. In fact, a lot of the people who are intentionally and maliciously deceitful, a lot of criminals who engage in intentional, malicious, deceitful behavior, are able to ply their trade because we naturally trust people. If you don't naturally trust people, if we don't assume that people are what they appear to be, and if we don't assume that people have generally benevolent intentions, we can't even function. We can't even move through life. You know, people who are mentally ill and are very paranoid and they think that everyone's, you know, out to get them in some way, they see monsters where there are no monsters, it's very difficult for them to function. Difficult for them to have a job or work with the family or something, because they're seeing enemies everywhere. And we depend on this currency of trust. Now, one problem is, though, that one of the propensities of all conditioned souls is to cheat. That means all conditioned souls. That means everybody that we associate with and ourselves as well. That we have this tendency to cheat. Of course, who's the main person that we tend to cheat?
Ourselves.
We tend to be the most dishonest with ourselves. We tend to be dishonest with ourselves about our motives. We tend to be dishonest with ourselves about our own reliability and so forth. So that other people often see us much more honestly than we see ourselves. But we have a real disconnect here between that we can't function unless we assume that most of the people we deal with most of the time are benevolent and trustworthy. You just can't go through life. You can't walk down the street. You can't go into a shop. You can't do anything unless you have that assumption. And at the same time, all of us are cheaters. Anyone who's not a liberated soul, anyone who's not an enlightened being, has this tendency to cheat. We have four basic problems, right? We have imperfect senses. We see a street sign at night in the fog and we think it's a robber. Right? We have a tendency to make mistakes. We can be illusioned. And we also have this tendency to cheat. And the combination of our deep need for authenticity and the fact that all of us have this cheating tendency makes life pretty unbearable to a large extent. Because we're being let down over and over and over and over again. You know, we let ourselves down. We make promises to ourselves. And we try to be a particular kind of person and behave in a certain way. And we fail in our own promises. We probably deceive ourselves more than anybody else deceives us. And then also the people that we deal with, they deceive us. They say, yes, I'm going to do this, or I'm going to be like this, and I'm going to be there. And then they're not. Then they're not. And as I said, this is really one of the biggest sources of grief for us. One of the hardest things for us to handle. So I thought we would look at Bhagavata and Manushiksha and what they say are the causes of this deceit and what they suggest as the solutions for it. And I find it interesting, quite interesting, that Raghunath Das Goswami in Manushiksha, which is Manushiksha means instructions to the mind, it's a very important guidebook for anyone on the path of bhakti yoga, that he really puts this deceit at right at the root of all of our problems in conditioned life. And the eradicating it as the main solution. Which makes a lot of sense, because if you're going to think about enlightenment, you're thinking about coming to the absolute truth. Not the absolute truth in the sense that we're absolutely right and everybody else is absolutely wrong. Not that kind of self-righteousness. I met one person who said, I don't like it that you Hare Krishnas talk about the absolute truth as if you're always absolutely right and everybody else is absolutely wrong. That's what we mean. But we mean that the ultimate reality, Krishna, is absolutely true. There's nothing false in him. There's nothing deceitful in him. Everything is completely authentic. And we have in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, Param Sattvam Dhimahi, I meditate on the supreme truth. In fact, the word for goodness in Sanskrit, sattva, also means truth. And sat means existence, spiritual existence. So spiritual existence is all good and all true. So if we want to enter into that truth, if we want to enter into truth, then we also have to be true. If I'm full of falsity, how am I going to enter into the absolute truth? And Srila Prabhupada would talk about, you know, if you want to go in the water, you have to have a suitable body for living in the water. You know, I can't live in the water. I have to have a suit on, right? I can't just go in the water. So if I want to be in the existence of truth, if I want to be in the spiritual world, then I won't be able to function there if I have falsity in me, if I have deceit in me. So you can see why we could say that deceit is the root of our material conditioning, of our material entanglement. It's the root because it's the antithesis of reality. Just logically, the antithesis of what's real is what's false. Yes? The antithesis of truth and authenticity is deceit. So therefore, it is at our very root. All right. So we're going to start from 482. Where it's interesting that this whole discussion is in the context of persons. So the Bhagavatam is explaining these different qualities as persons. And of course, although there is some metaphorical content here, there are real persons that are being described. So these different qualities have entities in the universe that personify them. Our philosophy is given by the Bhagavatam is extremely personal. That everything is ultimately run by a person. There's nothing that's just mechanical. So there's a person who personifies irreligion. That is this person. And again, by irreligion, religion, we don't mean, you know, do you wave this kind of a candle this way, or, you know, do you wear a sari, or do you wear a nun's habit, or we don't mean that kind of thing. Do you say prayers in Latin or Sanskrit? But by religion, we mean Sanatan Dharma, which is the basic quality of the soul, and that is to give and to serve. So irreligion is the opposite, to take. And this irreligion has children of falsity and deceit. And these children produce bluffing, cheating, and hypocrisy. And these children, their descendants are greed and cunning. And their descendants are anger, envy, lust, anger, envy, greed, and illusion. Their descendants are still more falsity and harsh speech. And their children are death and fear. And their children are great pain and more death. I thought that was fascinating. You start off with irreligion and deceit, and you end up with great pain and fear and death. Now, most of us would like to get rid of great pain, yes? Anybody want to be in great pain? So most of us want to get rid of great pain. We'd like to get rid of fear. We'd like to get rid of death. But those are the final fruits up at the top of the tree, the root of which is this irreligion and falsity. And again, these are explained in the Bhagavatam as actual persons that exist in the universe that then have these children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Now, in Manushiksha is described in text 6 and text 7 as something like a plant, that there is a seed, and the seed of this plant is the desire for fame and adoration. So this is how the whole thing begins, which is also described by Bhaktivinoda Thakur as one of the main weaknesses of heart, that I want everyone to honor me. I want everyone to worship me. I want everyone to adore me. I want to be at the center. I want to be at the center. I want it all to be about me. Everything is about me. Now, we can understand logically that obviously I am not at the center. Right? I'm not. None of us can say, I'm the center of my family. Anybody here can say, I'm the center of my family? Or, my family is the center of London. Or even, you know, London is the center of the earth. I mean, sorry. I'm from New York, so I think New York is the center. But, you know, and then the earth, is the earth the center of the solar system? I mean, they used to think so. Is the solar system the center of the galaxy? Is the galaxy the center of the universe? Is this universe even the center of all reality? So to say that I'm the center is obviously absurd. Even this planet isn't at the center. What to speak of me being at the center? So as soon as I have this desire that everything is about me, but most of us live our lives basically like that. Our consciousness is very much rooted in our body and our mind. We're aware of our thoughts and our desires and our plans and our actions. And we tend to perceive everything and everyone else in relationship to ourselves. Yes? That's generally how we go through life. We generally have very, very little awareness of what the experience in this room is from the perspective of the other people in the room. I found it quite fascinating that I'm sure you've heard about people who've had near-death experiences.
Yes.
Yeah. So there's many people who have these experiences will also have what they call a life review, where, you know, they somehow they see their whole life, every detail of their life, but very, very fast. Very fast. And pretty much everyone who has this experience describes it in a very similar way. They'll say, I re-experienced my life, but I re-experienced my life through the emotions of the other people that I was with. So as I had this review, I could feel what other people were feeling. And I found that really fascinating. I found that really, really fascinating. Because that experience is the opposite of what we generally experience as we go through life. Yes? Is there a chair for Bhagavad Gita? You know, okay. Generally, we go through life, as I said, unaware of other people's emotions and other people's experience of us. We are only aware of our own emotions and our own feelings and our own desires. We analyze and react to how other people treat us. And we very, 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 very rarely think about how I'm treating others and how they're experiencing my behavior. I mean, not too long ago, I was visiting a temple, and one of the people in the audience complained that when he had been chanting in the temple, someone else had asked him, "Why don't you chant in your home?" And he was very offended by that. He was very offended. It had been bothering him for months and months and months that he had been dealing, that he was dealt with like this. And one of the things I mentioned to him is, you know, maybe you've also offended somebody sometime. And later, some people came up to me and they said, probably the reason that that was suggested to him was that usually he comes and causes trouble. But he was unaware of how he was causing trouble to others. He was only aware of how other people were causing trouble to him. So our consciousness of myself at the center is false. And this agitation that one feels, why don't people respect me? Why don't they honor me? Why don't they care about my feelings? Why don't they give me what I need? Me, 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 me. And the more that we put me at the center, the more aggravated and agitated and angry and frustrated and disappointed and sad and on and on and on. That final fruit, remember that final fruit way up there of the great pain. So Bhagavatam is saying you're starting with this falsity, this irreligion. And you're going to end up from irreligion, right, to hypocrisy, to bluffing, to greed, to anger, to envy, to harsh speech, to death, to fear, to great pain, all the way at the top fruit of this tree. Pain and disease and death is the ultimate fruit of this irreligion, this false thing that it's all about me. And as soon as it's all about me, and everything in the world is all about, the weather is all about me. You know, if the sun comes out, God made the sun come out because I had some plan for today. You know? I mean, it's amazing how much each of us feel that everything in the universe is about us. I often find it humorous that Srila Prabhupada, my spiritual master, one time he received a letter from one of his disciples, and the disciple wrote, "I have a very big problem." And then he went on to describe his problem. And he signed his letter, "Your most insignificant servant." And Prabhupada was laughing and laughing. And he said, "How can an insignificant person have a very big problem?" No? So as soon as we think, as soon as we have this mood that people are supposed to take care of my convenience and my pleasure and my happiness, not only people, but animals, not only animals, but the weather. You know, everything is supposed to do my bidding. My body's supposed to do what I want it to do. My mind is supposed to do what I want it to do. All the other people in my life, especially my family and my friends, you know, my other countrymen, the government's supposed to do what I want it to do, the weather, the demigods, everything's supposed to do what I want to do for me. So as soon as we have that mood, because it's patent nonsense, anybody can understand logically that this is completely absurd. None of us is at the center of anything except our own ego. And really, if each of us is the center, how is the universe going to revolve around each of us? While it's busy revolving around me, how is it going to revolve around you? You know, that's going to be a little inconvenient. If you need rain today and I need sunshine, it's going to be a problem. Right? And in fact, Srila Prabhupada talks about this, how the thief is praying, "Please, please let me steal something tonight." And the householder is praying, "Please don't let the thieves steal anything." And Prabhupada said, "God is bewildered. He doesn't know what to do." You know? How does he take care of both of the prayers? So it's from this irreligion the opposite of reality, which is, of course, that Krishna is at the center, that springs deceit. Because when I'm starting with a false premise that I'm at the center and I'm the most important and everything's about me, because it's simply not true, then I build my whole existence on deceit. And we have we're working on a translation of Manushiksha, and we've done it. One of our artists has done a very nice picture of a tree, because this is the seed, is this irreligion and this desire for honor. This seed of this desire for honor producing this tree, and on the tree are many masks. So hanging on each branch of the tree, there's a mask. And if we really think about it, what are we doing in our life? We're putting on different masks. We're taking on different personas. There's very few people, maybe there's not even anybody, that we're totally authentic with. We have this kind of persona for this person, this kind of persona for this person. And each of it is some sort of pretense about who and what we are. And of course, ultimately, we're pretending to ourselves. We're pretending to ourselves. We're going to be looking at Bhaktivedanta Manor on Monday, a very interesting verse about persons who are hating themselves. It says, Brahma Danda Hata. Brahma means the self or spirit. Danda means to punish. Hata means like to kill, to destroy. People who are trying to destroy themselves. And it says in the Bhagavatam, anyone can find enlightenment except those who are killing animals or killing the self. Now, you can't kill the self. Najayate miyate vakadachi nayambudva bhavitavana buyaha ajo nitya shasvatoyam prayona hanyate hanyamaneshri. The soul never dies. What we mean by killing the self is we want to destroy who we really are and pretend that we're something that we're not. So we pretend I'm important, I'm smart, I'm capable, I'm wonderful, I'm wonderful, I'm wonderful. And I really care about you, whereas actually I'm really concerned with how much you care about me. So we put on all of these pretenses. And from those come, as Bhagavatam said, greed and cunning. Well, if it's all about me, then I want the most for myself. Now I want the most for myself. I'm going to try to make as much money as I can. If I can't do it legally, well, then I'll do it not so legally. And if my making a lot of money means that somebody else makes less, well, after all, I'm smarter than them and more capable and I'm much more important and it's all about me anyway. So, you know, those foolish people that bought the wrong stocks and, you know, now I've got the extra 10,000 quid in my pocket and out of theirs. And one starts to become greedy. More and more and more. Because it's a false platform. I'm not going to be satisfied. If I was on a platform of reality, I wouldn't have greed. I'd be satisfied. And then cunning. How can I get more? How can I convince people to believe in my pretenses? How can I convince people that I'm really at the center? And then anger and envy. Envy, well, wait a minute, if I'm really the center, why does that person have as much as I have? Or why do they have more than I have? Why do they have better than I have? That's not fair. I'm much more qualified. I'm a better person. Look at that person, has so many faults. I have somebody who regularly says these kind of things to me. You know, I'm a good person. Why? And look at that person. They're not so nice. Why do they have more money than I have? Oh, I should have everything. And then anger. Why aren't people treating me right? Why aren't I getting what I want? How come things aren't going my way? My body isn't obeying me. My mind isn't obeying me. My dog isn't obeying me. You know, it's not working. I deserve it. And I am the center. I really am. But I'm not. And so I become very angry. And then harsh speech. Speak harshly to others to try to get them to do our bidding. And then fear. fear that my pretenses will be exposed, that my real situation will be obvious, that I really won't get everything that I need, that I really won't find the happiness that I seek. And then why great pain? Why great pain? Well, one thing is that by trying to put myself at the center, I'm harming others. And half the time, I'm not even aware that I'm harming others. I'm sure most of the people who right now in London are putting a piece of meat into their mouths are not at all thinking of the pain that they're causing that creature. It's probably completely out of their consciousness. Yes? So because I'm causing great pain to others, I also have to suffer the karmic reaction of great pain. And I'm thinking it's okay to give great pain to others because, after all, it's all about me. So if someone else has to suffer for me, well, that's okay. So then I also go through great pain. And ultimately I grow through great pain because saying that I'm at the center is against my own nature. Therefore, I'm really damaging myself. I mean, we all have experience, even in ordinary life, that if we really try to be something that we're not, we become miserable, yes? It becomes a huge strain on us, a huge drain on us, to keep up some heavy kind of pretense. And so if the core of our behavior is pretentious and false, that is also the cause of all of our pain. And we can even think of it in a little different way, that, you know, Krishna is really at the center. But when I try to put myself at the center, I start coming into conflict with everyone. If everyone thinks they're at the center, then everyone's going to conflict with one another. And Srila Prabhupada gives the example that you throw rocks into a pond. And if you throw rocks into the pond, if you throw them in different places, they create ripples that will collide with one another. If you threw them all in the same place, they would create concentric circles. So by each of us taking this position that I'm the most important and everything's about me, we collide with one another. And we end up causing each other pain. Also, because this body and this mind are Krishna's energy, Bhumir Apanalo Vayu Kamano Buddha Eva Cha. As soon as I start thinking it's my energy, that this body and mind should be my servant, then I'm in conflict with reality and I experience pain in my body and mind. When I think that nature should obey me, you know, if I want to go somewhere, the weather should accommodate me and where I want to go and what I want to do. Because nature is really dependent on God, Daivyeshu Gunamayi, it's Krishna's energy, not my energy, then I come into conflict again with that energy. A simple example we could give is just like we were singing before and we were all trying to sing together. We were trying to sing the same tune and play the instruments in the same tune at the same time. And although we were all individuals and we were all making an individual contribution, we were working voluntarily in harmony. And therefore, all of us got to enjoy something that was greater than our own contribution. Right? We got to enjoy something more than if we were just sitting at home singing by ourselves. But if anybody here had decided, you know, well, I'm more important, then they started doing singing in their own way, then it would cause disturbance for them and for everyone. So having this false idea that I am the center, then it's like everybody's singing their own song at the same time, all in their own tune. And then instead of something pleasing, it becomes displeasing. So that is why there's this great pain that stems from this irreligion and deceit. We are then in conflict with our own bodies and mind, we're in conflict with other living beings, and we're in conflict with nature. Ultimately, we're in conflict with our own self. Because our self is glorious, and our self is wonderful, and our self is important, and our self is valuable. It's wonderful and glorious and important and valuable when it's in truth. When it's in truth. You know, the solar system is beautiful, but everything's revolving around the sun. It's not that every planet is trying to get all the other planets to revolve around it. And there's a beauty and a harmony in that relationship. So we're all part and parcel of Krishna. And we're glorious like Krishna. We're not as great as Krishna, but we're as great as Krishna in terms of our qualities. And when we're in our right position, then we shine with, practically speaking, unlimited glory and unlimited happiness and knowledge. But if we hate the fact that we're just a part of Krishna, if instead we want to be Krishna, then we're doing violence to our own self and setting up this deceit. Now, Raghunath Das Goswami also gives some very interesting analogies. So he says this desire for fame and adoration, the desire to be at the center, the desire to be the most important, he compares this to a very low-class prostitute who eats very disgusting food, who's eating dogs. And this very low-class, unchaste woman is glorifying us. Just like when people go to a prostitute, the prostitute tells the man, "Oh, you're the most wonderful man I've ever met. You know, you're the most handsome man. You're the most glorious man. I love you so much. And I'm sorry your wife doesn't appreciate you. I don't know why she doesn't, how wonderful you are." Does any of that mean anything? Does she mean any of it? It's all lies. It's all lies. Right? The prostitute is glorifying her customers, not because she actually thinks they're glorious. In fact, most prostitutes find their customers rather revolting, but just to get their money. So this internal desire for fame and adoration to be at the center, and this voice inside of us that says, "You deserve, you have a right. Why are other people treating you like that? Why is life like that?" It's exactly like the voice of this prostitute who's saying, "You're the most wonderful, glorious, handsome, clever man on the planet." And what gets stolen from us, just like the prostitute's business, is simply to take the money from her customers in exchange for a false demonstration of so-called love. So this desire for adoration, it steals the real treasure of the heart. The real treasure of the heart is bhakti, it's prema, it's love. And because love is about giving, and love is about absorption in the glories and the wonder and the beauty of the other rather than absorption in oneself, that jewel gets stolen from us, that ability to love.
It's from last night.
Oh, it looks like it's very fresh.
Yeah.
Wow, thank you. We lose that ability. You know, the man spending all his money on the prostitute, he doesn't have any money left to spend on his genuinely loving wife at home. Now, he doesn't have any money to spend on his children and so forth. So by listening to this voice of false adoration, we lose the capacity to love. Love means thinking about the other, doesn't it? Love means thinking how to make the other happy. Love means seeing the good in the other. Love means sacrificing for the sake of the other and finding joy in such sacrifice. Love means losing awareness of oneself. Being so absorbed in the fascination and the adoration of the other, of the one that one loves, that instead of one being absorbed in one's own image in the mirror, one's absorbed in the image of the other. Isn't that a fact? Everyone here has loved somebody. Instead of spending your money on yourself, you spend your money on the one you love. Isn't that a fact? Your consciousness becomes giving. And is there anything more incredibly happy than that kind of love? Everyone is looking for that kind of love. And that is our jewel. Of course, that love is ultimately meant to be given to Krishna, at which point it can then also be given to every living being. But we can't. We don't have it anymore. We're giving that adoration instead to ourselves in a false way. So he compares this to this prostitute who's a dog eater, a very degraded person, and simply stealing that wealth. And then he says that when one allows this dog-eating prostitute to dance in the heart, then there's no room for the beautiful lady of bhakti to enter. the lady of love and the lady of devotion. She can't enter the heart. The beauty is gone. The splendor is gone. And then again, what is the result of this adoration? As we said, the result is deceit and hypocrisy. Because as I'm in self-adoration, I'm doing something false. To maintain this idea that I am at the center and I am to be adored, I have to put up a pretense because it just isn't true. I can't justify it on the basis of anything true. It's just not real. So what comes from this is then deceit. And Raghunath Das Goswami has another analogy for deceit. He said, practicing deceit is like trying to take a bath in the urine of a donkey. Now, most of us don't see donkeys very much in our modern London, so perhaps this analogy doesn't mean very much to us. But in Raghunath Das Goswami's society, donkeys were very common. And I'm sure that people sometimes got donkey urine on them in the course of having donkeys in the environment. Just like one of my friends just wrote, he was in India. He was going into a building, and he thought, oh, why is it raining? It's not the rainy season. And then he sees it, some monkey urinated on him. So that's not very uncommon if you're in a place with lots of monkeys. So donkey urine is very burning. It's very burning. You know, when we take a bath, it's soothing, right? It's soothing and refreshing. And afterwards, we feel clean. But if you take a bath in donkey urine, while you're bathing, you're going to feel burning. And after you come out of the bath, you're going to feel dirtier than before the bath. And so this is what Raghunath Das Goswami compares deceit to. That when we're pretending, and again, we all have this experience, that as soon as I'm pretending to be smarter than I am, more knowledgeable than I am, more beautiful than I am, have more connections than I have, be more capable than I am, whatever, right? It feels yucky, doesn't it? Right? It's not that you walk away feeling good about yourself. The whole time you're thinking, you know, if people knew what I really was like, they wouldn't like me anymore. Right? They'd probably just turn around and walk away. And it has this horrible, yucky feeling. So what is the solution for all of this? What does Raghunath Das Goswami give as a solution? All right, well, we're going to start at the top. I'm going to start at those fruits that are on the tree and gradually go down to the tree itself. Now, in the Bhagavatam, it starts with the root of the problem, with this irreligion, that I'm the center instead of God's the center, and this desire for adoration, and then the verses go in three verses, as I said, 4, 8, 2, 3, and 4, to finally the last one is great pain and death. And Raghunath Das Goswami goes in reverse order. So Raghunath Das Goswami says, you know, first you get rid of this, of lust, anger, envy, greed, illusion, then you get rid of deceit, and then finally you get rid of this desire for honor at the root. So it's the way Raghunath Das Goswami is describing it, it's like you have this big tree, and you first cut off the top of it, and then you cut off the middle of it, and finally you pull the root out. Yes. And something, of course, he doesn't describe it as a tree, but you can understand like that. Of course, Krishna describes the whole thing as a tree. So Raghunath Das Goswami starts with the six enemies: lust, anger, envy, greed, and illusion, which aren't the final thing. The final thing is the great pain that we feel from all of these. So he says the way we get rid of lust, anger, envy, greed, and illusion is we call out to the enlightened souls. We call to the souls who are free from these things themselves. And he refers to these enlightened beings as servants of the killer of Baka. So Krishna is known as the killer of Baka. Baka was a great demon, a great shape-changing wizard who took the form of a huge crane. And he is said to personify or represent deceit. So those who are the servants of Krishna, who destroys deceit, and they themselves are free from lust, anger, envy, greed, and illusion. And Raghunath Das Goswami describes his lust, anger, envy, greed, and illusion as if they were robbers along the road. You know, you're walking on the road. He says you're walking on, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says you're walking on a shining path. You're trying to walk on the shining path to enlightenment. You're trying to walk on the shining path to spirituality. And as you're walking on this path, there's these robbers along the road. And they have nooses. They have ropes. And the ropes are made of wicked deeds. All of the things that we've done that cause pain to others with the mood of serving ourselves. And these things that we did to cause pain to others, or we're doing to cause pain to others, sometimes, as I said, without even our awareness of it, they form ropes that lust, anger, envy, greed, and illusion are using to pull us off this shining path. But when we call to the other enlightened beings, you please come and save me, then they come and cut these ropes. Now, how does that happen? It can happen because those who are already enlightened can see us truthfully. And this, my dear friends, is one of the most beautiful and wonderful things. We put on our masks and we put on our pretenses and we put on our deceit because we are terrified that if anybody saw us honestly, they would hate us. I mean, something like you see, you know, the women who put on a ton of makeup and dye their hair and put all sorts of padding and under some parts of their clothes and then elastic under other parts of their, you know, elastic on some parts of the body and padding on other parts of the body. And they're terrified that if they were to go as they are, then nobody would even look at them. Yes, this is the terror, the stars who don't want to be seen without all of their makeup and their etc., etc., etc. So we also have this fear, you know, if somebody were to see really how foolish I am, how selfish I am, how useless I am, that I would not be lovable. But the enlightened beings, they see us honestly. Because, my dear friends, when one is no longer cheating oneself, one not only sees oneself honestly, but one can see everyone honestly. As Krishna says, this knowledge lights up everything, like the sun lights up everything in the daytime. So one who's enlightened not only sees themselves honestly and they're authentic, but they can see through everybody else's disguises and everyone else's pretenses. And yet, they have love for everyone. Yet, they have love for everyone. We saw this, of course, in Srila Prabhupada. And we've seen this in all of the great saints and sages throughout history. They see what our problems are. They see our attachments. And they also see that under all of that is the glorious, wonderful spiritual being. And they love us for who we really are without even taking into account all of our problems and attachments. And because those beings both see us completely honestly and have full love for us, they're able to guide us how to get rid of lust, anger, envy, greed, and illusion. Nobody else can properly guide us because nobody else can properly see what the problem is, nor can anybody else see who our real self is. It's something like if you think about a doctor who sees the symptoms of disease clearly and also sees that what you're meant to be is healthy. The doctor sees the ideal healthy state of the body. At the same time, it sees these symptoms of disease, honestly, which we cannot necessarily do ourselves. I know when I was teaching children for many years that one way that I dealt with the children was to see them as potential adults. You know, children generally misbehave and they can't control their senses and they tend to be very egotistical and so forth. But if you see past that and you see, wait a minute, this person is a potential adult. What could they be? What could they use these activities for? And you love them for that. And you don't take into account their current bad behavior. You see their current bad behavior is just simply a result of being a child. So the enlightened beings are like that. They don't really take our current bad behavior into account, but they see it very clearly. And they can say, here's the real you, here's the glorious you, but this is also what you're doing wrong, and this is what you need to do to take care of it. It's not just that the enlightened souls help us in some sort of mystical, magical way. I mean, that's also there. It says if you take the dust from the feet of a great sage, or you eat their food remnants, or you just see them for a moment, that can be enough. Lava mudra, just 11th of a second association with a saint can be enough to purify one. But generally, they purify us because they give us instructions. And they can give us instructions because they see us clearly. And they're giving instructions, not only do they see us clearly, but they really love us. So they're giving instructions for our benefit. So then we can get rid of lust, anger, envy, greed, and illusion. But what gave birth to them was this deceit and pretense. And remember, this deceit and pretense were being compared to the donkey urine. So if you're covered with donkey urine, how do you get rid of it? By taking a bath in water. So Raghunath Das Goswami says, you go to the Ambu, you go to the water. And what is this water? This is the water of love that's at the lotus feet of the Lord. Now, this, of course, is again, a figurative analogy. But Krishna and his associates certainly do like water. So they bathe in the Jamuna, they bathe in Radhakund, Shamakund. If you go to Vrindavan, you'll see there's so many ponds of water. And in the stories of Krishna's pastimes, so many, many times in the course of every day, Krishna likes to take these baths in water. And this is the liquid of love coming from the Lord. And particularly, Raghunath Das Goswami uses two names for the Lord. He calls him Giridhari and his consort Gandharvika. So Giridhari means one, Giri means hill, Dhari means one who holds up. That Krishna held up the great hill of Govardhan. So he's very strong, he's very powerful. This water of love coming from Giridhari is powerful enough to wipe off and wash off all of this burning, all of this pain, all of this contamination of deceit, that one can feel clean in one's own self. And then Gandharvika is a name for Radharani, meaning that she's a very beautiful singer. The Gandharvas are very beautiful singers. And again, this beauty of the song of Radha acts like a bath to wash off our deceit. And filled in this love of beauty and harmony and strength, we no longer want to pretend to be someone that we're not. We start to feel happiness in who we are, because we start to see that who we really are, we start to experience that who we really are is so much more wonderful, so much more beautiful, so much more powerful than anything we ever pretended to be. We're an eternal soul. We have a beautiful, eternal form that's made of our particular love for Krishna. We have access practically to the same knowledge as God. We have unlimited joy. We start to experience, as we bathe in this love of Gandharva Giridhari, we start to experience, this is my real self. Why should I pretend to be something falsely great when I actually am something that is really great? What is the use of pretense? Why do it at all? Right? Why put on makeup and hair dye if I have natural beauty? What is the point? And one automatically and naturally rejects these pretenses. So that's what comes from bathing in this water of the love of Gandharvika Giridhari. And then to get to the very root, this desire to be the center, to have fame and adoration and honor, Raghunath Das Goswami says, to get to this root, you should serve the commander of the devotees. You should serve the chief of the saintly persons. Not only just to follow their instructions, not only just to be in their association, but to render service to them. Because that is the antithesis of irreligion. Irreligion is everyone is meant to serve me. And if we really want to root out this, we serve. And we serve not only God directly, but we serve his servants. And really serve out of love, not serving as a bargain. I'll serve you so you can serve me. Not serving because I think if I serve them, then it will be nice for me, it will be auspicious, I'll get what I want. But serving because we're just so inspired with love. We want to serve exactly like the man takes his hard-earned money and goes and buys a dozen roses for the woman he loves, even though they're expensive. And the flowers live for a few days. But just out of affection. So this is our real cure for deceit, and there isn't any other real cure for deceit. You know, one can pass legislation, one can have, you know, panels and investigation, one can have a free press, one can train students in values in the schools. But unless and until we get to this root and go to the reality, then we're going to keep growing this tree, the fruit of which is great pain. And we may blame this pain on others, on society, ultimately on God, but it will exist as long as we maintain this false concept that it is all about me, when it's really all about Krishna. And of course, the ultimate irony is when we really make it all about Krishna and we get so absorbed in love for Krishna and Krishna's servants that we forget about ourselves, that we're so filled with the happiness of love for Krishna. The irony is that Krishna then does make it all about us in truth. Each of Krishna's gopis thinks, Krishna's just coming to my house. Each of Krishna's cowherd boys think, I'm Krishna's favorite. And Sanatana Goswami says, and each one of them is. So when we're in our proper situation as a servant of Krishna and a servant of Krishna's devotees, then to Krishna, we are everything. Not because we actually are everything, but because he loves us. And when you love somebody, no matter how insignificant that somebody is in practical terms, to you, they're everything, isn't it? Right now in the world, so many people are dying, which in terms of world history, each of those people are insignificant and unknown. But to the people who love them, they're everything. So to Krishna, we're everything. And although we'll always be insignificant in a technical sense, we're never insignificant in the real sense of Krishna seeing us as the center of his life. That Krishna sees every soul like that. And that's the irony. When we come to the reality that there's no need of deceit, we actually get everything that we want. So I hope this was helpful. Anybody has any questions or comments? Yes.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Yeah, I'm really interested in what you said at the end about it. In the end, it is all about us in a way.
Yes.
How can we understand the differentiation between us not being special, but our personal relationship with Krishna being special? Because say if I endeavor to serve Krishna, I get a little bit of mercy, but there's a part of me that goes, oh, I'm special. I've impressed someone. You know? Is that still just my false prestige of thinking it's about me?
That is such a wonderful question. When Akura was going to Vrindavan to see Krishna, and he's thinking, when I get there, Krishna will call me Uncle Akura, and therefore my whole life will become glorious. So Srila Prabhupada comments in that connection that unless one wants to be recognized by Krishna, his whole life is condemned. So that feeling of I'm the most fortunate is there in all the residents of the spiritual world. Like Sanatana Goswami says, each cowherd boy thinks I'm Krishna's favorite, and each cowherd boy is Krishna's favorite. So that sense of being loved and being very fortunate in love is definitely part of our reality. At the same time, Krishna wasn't so happy when each of the gopis thought, well, I'm the most fortunate woman in the universe. And he left for a little while.
It feels like delusion still, like my old delusion, just in a new way.
Well, remember that everything that we experience in delusion has some existence in reality. That our bhakti yoga process is not a negation, but a restoration. We're not trying to negate anything. We're trying to bring it back to what it is. So there is a reality of everything that is an illusion at this point. And there's a reality to that also. The problem is when we think we're better than others. And when I think that everyone should serve me. That is the delusion, if I think it's all about me. So when the devotee sees himself as Krishna's favorite, that Krishna's only dancing with me, Krishna's only staying in my house, you know, Krishna's only looking at me, they're not really me-centered. What they're really thinking is, oh, I am bringing so much happiness to Krishna. They're not thinking, Krishna's bringing so much happiness to me. So the delusion is, how much can Krishna bring happiness to me? How can God serve me? Most religious people in the world are all about, how can God serve me? Right? Isn't that what's happening in most religious systems? Please God, give me this. Please God, give me that. Please God, do this. Please God, do that. You know, you bring your list. Like people bring their list to Santa Claus. Mm-hmm. Bring your list to God. You tell God how to run the universe. Okay, you should make the weather like this. You should make my bank account like this. And make my body like this. And make fix my wife. And et cetera, et cetera. So the devotee's feeling of being special to Krishna, which we are, is much more a feeling of, oh, Krishna's happy with me. I brought happiness to Krishna. Something like that, how you feel when someone uses a gift you bought for them. Something like that. They enjoy something you cooked for them. They're wearing something you bought for them. Something like that. Where we have a sense that I have acted as the catalyst for someone else's happiness. You know, what they do in charity programs, they send you a picture of the child who's poor and diseased, and you send some money, and they send you the picture of the child who's happy. And so I was the catalyst for their happiness. So that's how the devotee feels about Krishna. That it becomes about Krishna's happiness. It doesn't become about me. It's about Krishna's happiness. I lose myself in a sense in Krishna. And that's where we're the most happy. Again, that's the irony. The irony is, I'm the most happy when I lose all thoughts of my happiness in being absorbed in how I facilitated the happiness of others. Where I feel happiness at their happiness, but I'm not focused on my happiness at all. As soon as I focus on my happiness, I lose it. That's what Prahlad Maharaj said. He says, we're all naturally happy, but as soon as we try to find it, we lose it. So as soon as I think, how can I get happiness in this situation, it's just gone. Yeah. But you see, when your good friends or family, someone you really care about, and they just won an award, and you're feeling their happiness. You know, your good friend just is getting married, and you're experiencing their happiness, but you're absorbed in their happiness. You're not thinking, well, this wedding is all about me. I'm sure some people think that way, but you know, you think it's about them. And if you really care about them, you're happy that they're happy. So we have the moments like this, yes? And these moments that we have in our life, when I've contributed to someone else's happiness, and my happiness is their happiness. And the fact that I've played some role in that, that's when I'm taking happiness. Oh, I've done something for you. So it's that, some idea. Because in this world, even that is not pure. But some idea of what the feeling is. Does that help?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you for... a lot of times when we are trying to serve others, you know, different people want different things, and a lot of times there's conflict between them, or we're not quite right. I mean, we're not quite sure what should we be doing as, so to say, serving others. Now, we get scenarios where it's pretty clear from a spiritual perspective that that's the way to do it, but there's a lot of gray area where it's not that obvious. Or
could you give some specific example of what you're talking about?
Let's say take a temple scenario. Maybe a temple president wants you to do something, somebody else wants you to do something else, and a third person wants you to do something else.
Mm-hmm. Now, and you can't possibly please everybody.
Yeah, and how do you discriminate, or how do you make that choice of what's right?
The first thing is to give up the idea that I'm so great and powerful that I have the capacity to please everybody. You know, that's a lot of the illusion that I'm the center and I'm the most important. Not only am I the center and that everyone should please me, but that I am all-powerful and I can make everyone happy. You know, a lot of the big philanthropists get into this mood. I know Bill Gates said one time, I can do more for the world on a Sunday than by sitting in church. You know, he's thinking that I'm such a rich person that my money is going to save the world. And I'm going to be able, you know, I think right now he wants to wipe out some other disease. He's always trying to wipe out some disease. So, you know, I'm going to wipe out this disease in my lifetime, whatever it is. So to give up that idea that I have the capacity to satisfy anybody, I don't actually have the capacity. That the needs of another jiva, the needs of another soul, can only be satisfied by Krishna. I'm not capable. I don't have the capacity. I can satisfy some of your needs to some extent for a short period of time. I mean, it's very much like, you know, there's a little battery in your phone. And the battery in your phone can have a flashlight, right? I'm sure a lot of you have a flashlight in your phone. So with your phone, you could light up this room to some extent. Yes? If we turned off all the lights and one of you just turned on the torch that's in your phone, you could illuminate the room to some extent for a short amount of time. But it's limited. You have to charge the phone again. First of all, the light from that torch isn't powerful enough to light up the whole room. And then it's going to exhaust the battery very quickly using the torch. You're going to have to plug it back in. So each of us little jivas are like that. We have a very small battery that needs recharging. We can't exist very long without being connected. And therefore, I can't satisfy everyone. I just can't. Only Krishna can satisfy everyone. So that's the first thing, to let go of this conception that everybody's always going to be happy with me all the time. Even one person, what to speak of three or four. And then the question just becomes, well, what will satisfy Krishna the most? I can't really satisfy any living entity separate from Krishna. I'm not capable of it. But what can I do that will satisfy Krishna the most? And for that, of course, you can't give a formula. You can give principles. You can say, okay, well, what's my general service that I do? If we're all servants, we have our particular area. You know, the management gurus talk about your area of concern and your area of influence. You know, what is my area? What am I responsible for? And what am I not responsible for? And if you're not quite sure what that is, then that's one of the reasons that you have a guru and that you have other mentors and people to help you understand, you know, is this my service and is this not my service? Oh, no, thank you.
Nothing?
I don't think so. So that's the first thing to figure out. What's my area of service? If someone asks me to do something outside of my area of service, then do they have the authority to ask me that? Are they who's my authority? Who has authority over me? Just like if a police officer asks you to pull over, you have to pull over. But if some random person asks you to pull over, you don't have to pull over. I mean, you might, just because you might decide to, but that's something else. If you're going to go out of your area of service and out of your authorities, generally that's done only in emergencies. And then you have to discover, is this an emergency? Or then there's also desired activities. You might say, well, I would like to do this, and it's not going to interfere with my general service. But each of us has, there's our ordinary activities, our emergency activities, and our desired activities. So each of us has some a general role to play in the creation and some general role to play in the Lord's service. And one of the questions I get asked a lot of times is, how do I figure that out? So that's another big topic, which we don't have time to do tonight. But when I first read Bhagavad Gita and Krishna was talking a lot about prescribed duties, I didn't understand what he was talking about. What are prescribed duties? But each of us has our certain area. This is our area of service, and each of us have people who naturally are our authorities. So if something is in our area of service and they're coming from our authorities and what the, our authorities are asking us to do is in accord with the scriptures, then that's what we give priority to. Then we have our desired activities. They're not, you know, our regular service, but we want to do them. We like to do them. We may have people who aren't our authorities, but we may like to please them. We may like to help them. As long as that's not messing up our regular service, then of course you can do that. And then there's an emergency. So I was just reading this morning in the 11th canto that as soon as the emergency is over, you give up your emergency activities. You don't do emergency activities all the time. So there are some people who like to use an emergency mentality to get people to do emergencies constantly. Oh, please avoid such people. So, you know, if there's an emergency, you just see, is it a genuine emergency? How long is it going to last? What, you know? Sometimes you can't think about all that. If it's some emergencies, you just go and do it and whatever. You know? And that's how we know that we're pleasing Krishna. And some people will not be pleased with us. That's just life. You know, some people are not pleased with God, what to speak of. Some people are not going to be pleased with us. And to let go, wanting to please everyone is also very much part of this desire for honor and fame. It's very much part of this root of deceit. And very much why we put on all these masks. Because we're trying to be everything to everyone and that we just can't be everything to everyone. So allow people to see you honestly, which is as a fallible, tiny jiva. And that's okay. And if people think that you can't be everything to everybody, well, that's fine because you can't be everything to everybody. And it's really such a relief to not have to pretend to everybody that you can do everything for everybody all the time. And if somebody writes a whole article on the internet and just, he's not really God, you know, well, that's okay. Yes?
Well, when you're talking about these desired activities, what's the point where it becomes too much about us, where we're actually kidding ourselves, thinking that we're doing it?
It doesn't really matter whether it's a desired activity or an ordinary activity if your purpose is to please Krishna. It's irrelevant whether is this your regular normal work or is it something just like in a business. So let's say you have your job in a business and you have your regular work that you do, but you figured you finished all your regular work by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and you've looked around at the business, and because you really care about the business and you have some expertise, you're able to figure out that there are other things you could do that would really improve the company in general. Oh, yeah, I'll take that would really improve the company in general. So you go to your boss, or you go to the head of the company, and you say, I have these ideas that could improve the company. And if the boss approves them, then you can do them even though they're not part of your desired work. But if your motive for doing them is also to benefit the business, then what does it matter whether they're part of your ordinary work or your desired work? Now, if you're just doing your desired work and you don't get your ordinary work done, then that may be a disturbance. No, but most of us have time and energy left over from our ordinary work that we can do things that are in addition. And it doesn't make it about us just because it wasn't assigned to us. It doesn't make it more or less about us. In fact, even our ordinary duties are given to us in the scripture according to our nature. So even our ordinary duties are the things that we most enjoy, frankly. Are the things that make us feel most alive, are the things that are most in accord with who we are. But again, it's why am I doing it? Am I doing it for the benefit of Krishna, or am I doing it because I want everything to be about me? It's the consciousness. That's a lot of the message of the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says to Arjuna, no, it's not about whether you fight or not in this war. It's about what your motives are and what your consciousness is and what your identity is. That's really what it's about. What's really going to make this sinful or pious? What's really going to make it good or bad? What's really going to bring you liberation or bondage? isn't exactly the external activity, but what you're doing it for. Is that all right?
Yes.
But both ordinary and desired activities are in accord with who you are in your nature.
How do we make sure that we're not just creating excuses to do what we want to do?
Please do what you want to do, but do what you want to do for Krishna. You should do what you want to do. Just like Krishna told Arjuna, he said, it's your nature to be a warrior. That's what you want to do. He said, your choices are, do it for me or do it for illusion. Krishna never said to him, one of your choices is, just don't do it. He said, if you try to do something that's not your nature, you're going to do it anyway, because that's how you're made. That's what you are. You know, you're not going to get a car to act like a boat. It's just... And that's it. Wasn't that funny? It's a waste of your energy anyway. It's just a waste of energy, and it will bring you another birth. Frankly, if you try to be something that you're not materially, then you get to have another birth where you can be that thing. The point is, who are you doing it for? To please Krishna? You want Krishna at the center, or do you want yourself at the center? Yes.
You said that we cannot please everyone.
Impossible.
Impossible. But it's also said that those who please Krishna, they please everyone, and there is a comparison that when you water the root of a tree, all the branches and leaves are satisfied.
But not everybody will feel satisfied. But you will be factually acting in a way that is the most beneficial for everyone. Because as soon as I'm connected with Krishna, I'm in my right place. And I'm now doing things that are beneficial and auspicious for everyone. Will everyone appreciate it? No. Not everybody appreciates Krishna. So if not everybody appreciates Krishna, not everybody's going to appreciate me. No matter what I do. That's not possible. But will I be actually pleasing everyone? Yes, I'll be actually the best well-wisher and benefactor of everyone. Because I won't be dealing with anybody in an exploitive or selfish way. Just like we were saying, the enlightened beings, they both have real love and they see us honestly. So if we're an enlightened being, we will also be like that. But some people will not appreciate it. There's nothing you can do about that. Absolutely nothing you can do about it. You cannot force everyone in a position where they will understand who is their benefactors. As I say, even Krishna can't do that. That is the free will of the living entity. The free will of the living entity is they can choose not to see what's reality. So there's nothing you can do to interfere with people's free will. That's theirs. Everyone has their free will, and nothing, anybody, no one can interfere with that. That belongs to the living entity. You know, you can turn on a light and somebody can put a bag over their head. Right? I'm sure we've all had experience that we really cared about someone and we were genuinely their well-wisher and they just didn't see it. I'm sure we've all had that experience. That somebody thought we were their enemy when we were trying to help them. So that cannot be helped. There's nothing you can do to make every jiva appreciate you, even if you're an enlightened being. Otherwise, you know, why would Jesus have been crucified? And this is the way of the world. Yes. Bhagavatam.
Could you elaborate on that? Because I've got a lot of pain.
All pain is caused by our being in conflict with reality. I often give the comparison of a dance. So if there's a dance and everybody is in harmony, or like we were having a kirtan, everybody was in harmony. then everybody's contribution contributes to the whole that everyone enjoys that's greater than themselves, that the concept of synergy. Whereas as soon as one person is acting out of harmony, then that person comes in conflict with everybody else. So when we're out of harmony with Krishna, when we're out of harmony with the truth, we're then in conflict with everything. That's the adiatmaka adidaivika nadibhautika. We're out of harmony with our body and mind, which is Krishna's energy. We're out of harmony with other living entities who are also Krishna's energy, and we're out of harmony with nature, which is one of Krishna's energies. Because we're out of harmony with them, again, if you think it like a synchronized dance, and if one of the dancers decided they wanted to just do their own thing, they would start bumping into the other dancers. They would be disrupting the beauty of the dance as a whole. They'd be bumping into the other dancers, and they might even fall off the stage. So all of our pain is coming from that. All of our pain is coming from this root that I'm in the center. And then in a technical, specific way, as soon as I think I'm at the center, I start harming others, often without being aware of it. Like I said, I'm sure, like right at this minute, I don't know how many people in London are eating meat. I'm sure it's a few thousand. You know, right at this particular moment in London, I'm sure there's several thousand people that are putting a piece of meat into their mouth. And I would also guess that very few of those people have any conscious awareness of the pain that they are causing indirectly to another living entity. That by their buying this meat, they're fueling a slaughterhouse industry, which is causing pain to that animal. That is out of their awareness. Most of those people, if it was in their awareness, they wouldn't be able to keep eating it. So in a similar way, as soon as we put ourselves in the center, we are causing so much pain to other living beings. But it's out of our awareness. We're very aware of our own feelings and our own needs and our own desires, and we're very, very unaware of other people's feelings and other people's needs and other people's desires. It's out of our consciousness as much as the person, you know, all the people right now eating their hamburger. And we want it out of our consciousness. If you went to those meat eaters and you showed them, you know, videos of the slaughterhouses, they would tell you to go away. They wouldn't say, oh, thank you very much for bringing this to my attention. A few of them would, but most of them wouldn't. Most of them would become angry. They don't want to know how they're causing pain to others. They just want to eat something that tastes good to them right now. They don't want that awareness. So all conditioned souls are more or less doing this. We are causing pain to other living entities. Have to be. As soon as I put myself at the center, I must be causing pain to others. There's no escaping it. And I put that out of my awareness because I don't want to see that. One of the things that happens in bhakti is you will start to understand how you are actually causing pain to others. And because I'm causing pain to others, I also have to suffer from that pain. That is just, is it not? What kind of reality would there be if such a thing wasn't the case? So, frankly, all the pain that each of us have experienced in our lives and are experiencing, all of us experience pain of some nature. Frankly, that is the pain that we cause and are causing others. But we don't see it. And we don't see it because we don't want to see it. So therefore, pain is the ultimate, great pain, Bhagavatam says, is the ultimate result of irreligion. It's the ultimate, and by irreligion, we don't mean, again, is this person an infidel or are they a pagan or, you know, we don't mean like that. Are you a Muslim instead of a Christian or a Christian instead of a Muslim? You mean the concept that it's all about me instead of it's all about God. That is the essence. It's about me taking. Because Sanatana Dharma, the essence of religion, is service. At least that makes sense theoretically, yes?
Yes. So can we conclude
definitely. What happens when a person comes to reality frankly, is they no longer feel the pains of the world. They don't experience the pains of the world as pain. And at least we can have such experiences briefly sometimes. Prabhupada says that the materialistic people see the world as aggressive, but those who are spiritually advanced see everything as very happily situated. And as soon as one comes even to the threshold of the spiritual experience, one does not experience pain as pain. It's not that one is unaware, but one doesn't experience it as pain. Very much like when your car is low on petrol, you don't feel hungry. You know your car is low on petrol. You see the gauge. You know you have to put petrol in the tank. But you don't experience it as pain. If you drive, you know, down the road and there's been an accident on the side of the road and the ambulance is there, you may say, oh, it's a bad accident. But if you don't know the people, you don't feel pain. I mean, unless you get out and you start connecting with them. Maybe you just drive by some people you don't know. That's not painful. If you look at the newspaper headlines, you know, 10,000 people died here and 5,000 people are starving over there. And unless you get into some personal story where you connect with the individuals, it's not painful. But if you're driving down the road and there's a car accident and somebody you love is there, you know, your mother's there, your sister's there, your whatever, your brother's there, then you feel pain. Why? All of our pain is due to identification and attachment. And all of our identification and attachment is because we want to enjoy as a center. It's like somebody playing a computer game. So I've had the experience of being in the room when people were playing computer games, although I haven't played them myself. And I'll see that if they're absorbed in playing these games, then when the character gets something good or something bad, they get exaltation and pain. And they're suffering. But I'm who's in the room and I don't even know what the game is about. And I'm not playing the game because I have no attachment to it. I can also be looking at the screen and their character is sick on the screen. But because I'm not playing it and I don't have any attachment, I don't feel any pain. And the person playing it is just, they're screaming. I was once in a house where I walked in the living room and their teenage son was watching some sports. He was the only one in the room watching something on sports on television. And as I walked through the room, he jumps out of the chair, starts waving his fist in the air and screaming. And I saw the same television he was seeing. You know, I also was walking through the room. I was getting the same sensory input that he was getting. I was seeing the same thing he was seeing. I was hearing the same thing he was hearing. It had no effect on me at all.
They also say, we won the match, or we played well.
Yes, we won. Yes, right. And to him, I mean, he was screaming at the television set. Which I thought was rather interesting in and of itself, you know, and waving his fist at the television set, jumping up and down. And so that's the... And in Bhakti Yoga, we identify with a different world. We're not just trying to stop it. We're not trying to just stop and become nothing. We're trying to develop our real identity. When we're absorbed in Krishna, actually Krishna, 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 really Krishna, Krishna's form, Krishna's pastimes, then one will start identifying with that world, which is who we really are. And then our false identity slackens, and our experience of the pains and pleasures of this world will also diminish, and we will come to the reality, which is that we are simply observers. Bhagavad Gita chapter 5, Bhagavad Gita chapter 13, Krishna also discusses the 11th canto. We are only observers. Just like somebody playing a computer game. We are not really experiencing this world. But we will come to that not through philosophical but through absorption in the actual pastimes of Krishna, absorption in the world of Krishna. So that's what we want to do. We want to absorb ourselves in the world of Krishna. And those of us who have great pain in our life, although better if we could absorb ourselves in Krishna without that pain, it's not that pain is necessary. Pain is not necessary for spiritual advancement. You can have a life without any difficulty and make perfect spiritual advancement. You don't need to suffer to become spiritually advanced. But whatever suffering we have in our life, we can use it as an impetus. Because sometimes when the suffering is great enough, our hopes for trying to enjoy the world separately from Krishna become so absurd. And it's so hopeless and so ridiculous that we say, okay. You know, if you're really, really suffering, you say, I will do anything. Yes? The husband of one of my former students was diagnosed, he was about 30, with a very rare and dangerous cancer. And he was telling me the treatments he went through, which to me sounded like worse than death. So if we do go through great suffering in our life, which many of us do, again, it's not necessary for spiritual life, but if you have great suffering, that urge that I will do anything, do it. Take it. Use it. Use that tendency of us in a time of great pain to say, I will do anything. And then do the anything. Do the full absorption. Sometimes great pain and great suffering gives us that impetus. Better to have the impetus without the pain, my dear friends. Pain is not necessary. It's not necessary. And not Krishna's preferred means. I have a very big day tomorrow. So I think I should, and a bit of a trip back to where I'm sleeping tonight. So I think I should end here. I hope this was helpful. Yes. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Thank you, Prabhu. That's very nice.
Jai.